The following presentation was recorded at the 2014 Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute. More information at thedocforlearning.org.
We're up against a lot when we try to run a school. One attitude that we run into as teachers and the students run into this a lot is that school and learning is just a game. It's just something to do. We've got to get through the curriculum, we've got to do what the teacher wants, you know, for whatever reason, the teacher will be happy if I do it this way. It doesn't really have any meaning beyond school. And teachers can actually see their teaching as that way too. We can get stuck into this rhythm that ends up not being very meaningful. There you are. So that's one problem. Another thing that we come up against is that for many students, the main concern at school is just peer interaction. That's really what they get out of school. And their main concerns are whether they're accepted, popular, and smart. And for us to try to break past that reality for the students can be very, very difficult and try to actually accomplish what we are trying to accomplish in making disciples at school. Other things get in our way, frustrate us. Sometimes it feels like we're pulling against the parents, and we have a different agenda than the parents do, and that may be a problem. That may be our problem, actually, if it's the wrong agenda. Sometimes it's the parents' problem, but it's something we've got to deal with. To make things even more complicated, sometimes we're not always sure of our role as teachers and how it intersects with the parents' role. We know that educating the child is really the parents' responsibility according to the Bible. And we're not really mentioned in the Bible, but they have delegated that part of their role to us. So we feel a bit insecure about this sometimes. We know that our job mostly has to do with academics, and we need to leave the really serious spiritual stuff up to the parents. Don't we? What do you think about this? I thought I would have a little discussion to get some feedback from you on what you think of the teacher versus the parent's role in some of this stuff. Discipleship, in the student's spiritual life, etc. What do you think?
I hope that the teachers continue to do what I try to do at home, and that includes the role of the parts.
You hope the teachers do that too.
One of the things I appreciate about a Christian school is that I think the teachers can be affirmation to what I'm teaching. Mm-hmm. If the children hear the same thing in them, it gives a lot of credibility to my teaching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If they can work together, I think that's really powerful. And I read something. I'm going to be talking about Christopher Dock a bit. Christopher Dock did this. Christopher Dock did things that to us may seem like we're infringing on a parent's space. One thing he did was when a student would achieve a certain level of mastery, like they would learn the ABCs, they would get a reward, and the reward was the mom would cook the student two fried eggs, and the father would give him a penny. And so he had prescribed a reward that the parent would give for something done in school. Would you feel comfortable doing that? I hardly would, honestly. But maybe if I would be working with the parents more closely, and we would be pretty sure that our goals are about the same, we could be doing more of this kind of thing. Yes?
Just like everyone was just saying about the parents and the teacher working together, one thing that's helped me as a teacher is to make sure I remember the fact that, like you said, the parents have a responsibility to educate children. They've chosen to give me to help them. Mm-hmm. So I need to make sure that I remember that I'm working for the parents. Mm-hmm. And if it feels like we're butting heads, then I need to touch base with the parents let's say, less than the same page. Because you kind of have this competition thing that I think one of my children are, you know, maybe the issue that I need to accept is that my role for the student is not primary. Yeah, I think I can help that, but maybe that's the perspective that the parents may not have. But it's crucial that they see me as an asset in the combination of what they want for their children.
Absolutely.
And they have a primary responsibility there. If it's a thing that I thought should happen, I need to just let go and say, you know, that's not the parents' vision for the children.
Right.
I can enhance their vision, but I need to make sure that I'm not competition. Or we get in this situation where we're competing for that student's heart. That's being restrained.
You need to make sure that you're not subverting their vision, being subversive. I heard that at a meeting recently. We cannot be subversive as schools or teachers, either with what the parents are trying to do or with what the community is about. We can't come in there and try to turn things around in a sort of underhanded way. We'll lose trust. That's not what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be serving these people and helping them with what they're trying to do already. But I have a dream about our schools. I dream that our schools could be staffed by teachers and principals who have a long-term vision for the school, who dream of what their school could be. I dream that in our schools, love for our students and communities would run deep, that we teachers could care for our students enough that we are desperate to communicate not only knowledge, but also values, wisdom, skills, and attitudes to them, to see them grow into purposeful and thoughtful disciples. I dream of schools where students love their teachers, but those teachers love their students so much that they challenge them and confront them when needed. And I'm a person that has a lot of dreams, and often my dreams don't go very far, honestly. But this talk, I think, is meant to help me as much as anybody learn how to put a few things of these into practical reality, and I hope we can do that here today. I'd like to talk about three things: pursuing your students, communicating values, wisdom, skills, and attitudes, and having a plan for the whole school. So the first thing here, pursuing students. I alluded to this already, how that for our students, school is more about peer interaction than anything else. And that's unfortunate. Let me read you something I read in a magazine. Until the Great Depression, the majority of American adolescents didn't even graduate from high school. Once kids hit their teen years, they did a variety of things. Farm, help run the house, earned a regular wage. Before the banning of child labor, they worked in factories and textile mills and mines. All were different roads to adulthood. Many were undesirable, if not outright Dickensian, or like what you find in a Charles Dickens novel. But these disparate paths did arguably have one virtue in common. They placed adolescent children alongside adults. They were not sequestered as they matured. Now, teens live in a biosphere of their own. In their recent book, Escaping the Endless Adolescence, psychologists Joseph and Claudia Worrell Allen note that teenagers today spend just 16 hours per week interacting with adults and 60 with their cohort. One century ago, it was almost exactly the reverse. Something happens when children spend so much time apart from adult company. They start to generate a culture with independent values and priorities. And we know what that's talking about. And so, you know, are we really doing the right thing with this push to have more high school? Getting people away from adults with their peers more often? I don't know. Talking to Jeremy Souter, Jonas's son, once he had this wild idea that we should really get these when students reach this age, about ninth grade age or so, or eighth grade, we should just work them like crazy. You know, send them somewhere on the farm, whatever. Just really work them like crazy, and then when their minds have matured enough to the point where they're actually ready to start thinking, bring them back to school. And then we could have a profitable time with them. I kind of like that idea. I'm just not quite sure how to make it work. But if we don't think about this fact that for them, school is not about what the teacher's agenda is so much as what they're learning from their peers, we've got to work extremely hard to get past that. We've got to work incredibly hard to get through to these people whose world is, they're just tuned into each other way too much. Another major thing to think about as students are adolescents is that they are developing a concept of themselves, of who they are, that tends to stay with them for the rest of their life. As I think about what I decided about myself when I was 13, 14, 15, 16, I decided that I was a certain kind of person. I decided I wasn't this kind of person, I wasn't this kind of person. I looked at this role model and said, I'm more like him and I'm less like this one over here. And I like these certain things. I like this kind of music. I like thinking about these things, and I don't like thinking about these things. And that concept has stayed with me a lot. Now, a lot has changed, but a lot of that has stayed with me, and it was very powerful. And when students come up through our schools, they are making those kinds of decisions. We can't let that escape us as we try to shape them. And their parents are trying to do this too, but we just got to be conscious of what we're working with here, who we're working with. We cannot sit on the sidelines of their culture that they tend to develop. We've got to engage, and try hard to do something that is not natural for us, because we've forgotten that what it was like. We don't live there anymore. So we've got to engage with them. I was at a meeting recently where David Yoder from Dover, Delaware, he's the principal there at their school, he talked about what he calls a hand-on-the-shoulder theology. He's a very encouraging kind of a person, very relational. And I can see him just being a huge inspiration to those students as he puts his hand on their shoulder, as he really cares about them, who they are, what they're going through. He actually has regular meetings with his students. I'm fascinated by this. A couple times a year, he will have a personal meeting with each student. And they'll talk about things like their relationship with God, their relationship with their parents, how they're doing academically, if there's anything to pray for. And he said he takes his wife in for the meetings with the girls. But they do have these personal conversations. And that's, I was thinking, that's something parents... isn't that infringing on the parents' space and their domain? But, I don't think he is. They're careful about... parents trust him. He's not doing something they don't want him to do. And it can be very powerful for those students. Hand-on-the-shoulder theology. We have in our graveyard, at our church's graveyard, there's a stone, a little stone about 8 inches by 4 inches in the ground, away from the rest of the grave. It's up on the hill close to the church, actually. It's not even in the graveyard. It's right by the church. And this stone says the turning point, 1951, on it. It has an arrow turning 180 degrees. And the story behind this stone is that back in 1951, a brother in our church, Menachem Singer, his daughter is in here right now, he was a teen growing up, having a hard time, and thinking that maybe he wanted to run off, I believe. I'm not sure of the entire story there. But a brother, actually my grandfather, came up to him and just said, "Brother Menno, how are you?" Something like that. "Menno, how are you?" In such a way that he knew somebody, he felt that love, and it turned him around. Just that moment, which is why he put the stone there, so nobody will remember, nobody will forget. And it can be powerful. And above all the programs, the things that we do, this idea of knowing students, connecting with them, loving them, has got to be the most powerful way that we're going to disciple students at school. It's about that relationship. And it's the hardest thing also to do. I'm not really saying anything new here. I'm just reminding you. I know. We've got to go back and work really hard at that. We've got to challenge our students. One unfortunate part of teen culture is, in America at least, is that we see teen years as a time of irresponsibility. And that time of irresponsibility is turning into an extended childhood for a lot of people, where they just stay at home with mom and dad for a long, long, long time until they're maybe in their 30s and they're still not taking care of themselves, because it's just a lot easier to be a child for a long time. And, you know, I think, well, I don't have to say everything I think about that. It's kind of off the subject. This is a book that addresses that. You've probably seen this, Do Hard Things by Alex and Brett Harris. I like the ideas in here a lot, that teenagers are really young adults. We didn't used to have this time halfway between children and adulthood. There is a time when people become adults, and for the Jews, that used to be back at 14. They had their bar mitzvah, and they were now adults. So we've got to be treating our students as if they really are people who are capable of being responsible and of doing things that are significant. And I've tried to do that in my classroom. This fall I divided my class into groups of about four students or five students each, and appointed one of the high school boys to be in charge. And on Friday afternoons, they were to come up with things to do that would bless other people. And they did things like chopping firewood and selling it and using the money for a charity. They had a hot dog stand. They did all this work on the planning themselves. They did cleaning, yard work for people. And really, it really was good to see them do that. And I think they felt good about it. They weren't just in school listening to my directions all the time. They were out there actually doing something. I'm looking forward to hearing more. I think we have a talk this afternoon something about hearts of service. Maybe we'll talk more about that. Do hard things. Tell them that they need to be doing hard things. I had a student recently who did great with this. He, for a project in a missions elective, he was supposed to bless somebody. And he, I just read this the day before the report. He created a fictional email address called iwillprovidesupper@gmail.com. And he sent an email to somebody that recently had a baby, had a large family, and he said he was going to have pizza brought in for them, and he planned all this out, and he was actually on a trip when it happened, so he had to get some other people to help and to make all this happen and get their ultimate pizza to them. They still don't know who it was, and he had a great time with it, and it was very creative and a real blessing. In English class, we wrote biographies of people from our church and published a little book with these biographies in it. And I got the idea from Miriam Owashigi in Kansas. She sent me all these books. You should ask her. Maybe she can send you some too. But her high school class has been doing this for a long time. Every year they make a book. This is called Purposeful Peaceableness, Our Community's Participation in Civilian Public Service. And there's articles about all these people from their community written by different students right here. So this is just something you put together, you know, with your own copy machine and your stapler. It's so much more meaningful than just random essays that don't go anywhere. Something that has real world value. Challenge them to do things that are difficult and that are meaningful. Need to do more of that, actually. Also in the challenge department is confronting them about their short-sightedness, their immaturity, whatever they need to hear about. They need to be confronted about some of those things. And the word that David Yoder used there instead of confront is carefront. So carefront. Don't confront in a nasty way. But let them know that you're watching them. They need to hear about it when they need correction. And that should come from you as much as anybody. Okay, teaching values, wisdom, skills, and attitudes. In addition to teaching knowledge, which is what school is all about, we need to teach values, wisdom, skills, and attitudes. Values. You're not done too well with this. How do you teach students not to value those big, shiny trucks? You know, those are the values that they are growing up with. Those are the values that their peers have, that they have in their own little subculture. How do we challenge those values without turning them against us? I've been scared to go there, honestly. And maybe you have some thoughts on this. That needs to happen. Maybe you have more to say about that later. Yes.
I don't know. But one thing to consider, if the administration, school board would regularly have speakers come in and talk about the needs of the community or a foreign field, about what, like how little, how most of, a lot of people have, and how God's will to minister to us.
Yeah, bringing other, giving them a picture of the world bigger than themselves and how other people live. It's a huge part of that, I think. Yes.
One thing that challenged me was the thought that our students are designed to be lovers or able to love something. And that the teacher had the opportunity to help bring back people to mold that love. And realizing that they're not, like you mentioned, the big shiny trucks, they're not acting contrary to the way God designed them. They're misguided, but they are designed to love something. So to be able to give them something that's worthwhile is a, you know, not a confrontational way to call them something better. It's part of what we're here on.
Yeah. Thank you. Wisdom, teaching wisdom. You need to read Ted Tripp's books. Shepherding a Child's Heart is a very common, popular book. And then he has another one that I've not even read that I want to read, Age of Opportunity, about teenagers. How many of you have read that one? Is that one good? Yeah. So he talks a lot about wisdom in there and about bringing proverbs, especially, to bear onto a child growing up and, you know, applying scripture to daily life. And I really want to work on that. I need to do a lot more of that. Christopher Duff, he wrote, he did not seem to feel too confined to his place in the school as just a teacher of academics. is he wrote 100 rules of conduct for students, and these rules describe good conduct for children in the morning, at bedtime, at the table, at school, and on the street. Let me read you some of them. Dear child, as soon as you are called in the morning, arise. Indeed, accustom yourself to awaken at the proper time without being called, and to rise without loitering. And I'm sure the parents would appreciate that sort of admonition from you to their children. Accustom yourself to dress quickly, but at the same time, neatly. Do not eat your breakfast on the street or in school, but ask your parents to give it to you at home. After supper, do not sit in a corner to sleep, but attend to your evening devotions, psalm, prayer, and reading before retiring. At meals, avoid everything that indicates excessive hunger, such as looking greedily at food, being the first one in the dish, cutting one's bread all into pieces at once, eating fast and greedily, asking for another piece of bread before the first is eaten, cutting two large pieces, taking one spoon too full, filling the mouth too full, etc. Avoid, if possible, blowing your nose at the table. If it is necessary, turn your face from the table or hold your hand or napkin before it. The same when you sneeze or cough. Then he has the conduct of a child at school. Attend to all that is told, sit up straight, and look at your teacher. At school, avoid this scandalous talking, by which you make your teacher's work much more difficult, annoy other people, and disturb the attention of yourself and others. He has the conduct of a child in meeting at church. Dear child, in meeting or church, think of the sacred presence of God, and remember that you shall be judged according to the word you have heard that day. Actually, I talked to a student just the other day about how he sits in church with an incredible slouch and looks like he's falling asleep. You know, I try to teach them good posture in my class, but then I go over to church and see him doing this, and I realize my teaching is not taking hold. I need to. So I addressed him about it. He said he would like to change. We will see. So why not come up with something like this yourself? 100 rules. Have you ever heard of The Essential 55 by Ron Clark? It's a book that, it's kind of the same idea, it's just a modern educator, has written 55 rules for the conduct of his children, mostly what they do at school, like things like, he has a section on about not rolling your eyes. Okay, obviously we know that's a disrespectful thing to do, but students maybe don't know that if they've never been taught, so don't roll your eyes, and he has some role play, gets them up there to practice this, and shows them how to respond when they hear things that they don't like. He's the kind of teacher that likes to reward his students a lot. He bakes cookies for them, brings them in different times, and he teaches them if they ask for the reward, then they don't get them, even if he's already baked them and they're right there, you know. Or if they don't thank him for them properly, they're not getting them. He's just very intentional about teaching these things that they should already know, but maybe they don't, and they need reinforcement. We need to do that. Teaching skills and attitudes. One thing we could be doing a lot more of in our school, and we're going to try to do this, is teaching high school students how to do things that they need to do in church, like leading singing, and actually have them practice in church on prayer meeting evening or something, having devotions, and actually having them practice in church again, teaching Sunday school. I'm not sure if we're going to actually have them practice that in church or not, but help them to know what goes into that. And something I heard recently in relation to church and the kingdom is that, you know, we have all this language about the kingdom, and it's good, but if we do not talk about church and use the word church, then students tend to disassociate church from the kingdom. We should probably start using the word church a lot more again. I'm going to try to do that. And actually trying to create that association that church is where the kingdom happens, at least right here. And for you, that should be your main concern. We have a problem, with students not with, we have a problem in our church with young people not joining the church. It seems like just a recent thing. I don't know if any of y'all have the same kind of issues, but people are just deciding that, well, they have more options than they used to. Let's not join the church. Let's just wait and do what we want to do. School is probably a part of the answer to that problem. Leadership skills. I try to intentionally put my students into situations where they will have to exercise leadership. Like put them out there, tell them to play a game, not tell them all the details about the game, and make them figure it out on their own. And tell them ahead of time what's supposed to happen. Like, some of you boys need to take leadership here and figure this thing out. And there's not going to be any of this sitting around, everybody waiting for something to happen because nobody's telling you what to do. It's your job to do that because you're going to be in plenty of situations in life where you need to do that. And so that has actually worked pretty well. I think so, anyway. I don't always watch, but most of the time they're out there playing, they're doing what they're supposed to do, and they've had to figure out the teams, who goes where, on their own. I think I'm going to skip a few things here. Cooperation, you can teach them how to work with each other by putting them into cooperative groups to work on things and instructing them on how to get along with each other, how to argue or to discuss things and then to come to a solution, how to give in. That's a skill that can be very helpful in the church. You can address their competitiveness. I've ran across this paper recently, Virgil Nisley from Kansas, talked about practical suggestions to increase cooperation at school, and he talks about competitiveness where you try to help people become less selfish by, like in a volleyball game, when they get a point, the point goes to the other side. So, you get what I'm saying there? The competitiveness, you're actually helping the other team win instead of your own team. We haven't tried that yet, but I want to. Something that I used to do at school that I'm not doing because I think it taught the wrong thing was my high school students have chairs at their offices, have these office chairs, and they're, you know, from the thrift stores, the yard sales, whatever, and they're all different qualities and desirabilities of chairs. So everybody wants the best chairs. Well, it's always hard to get this thing sorted out. So I thought, well, this year I'm going to have a, they can switch their chairs often so that not everybody's stuck with the same chair. So every now and then I'd randomly have this chair swap day where the earliest students who would come to school would get to choose their own chairs. So I thought, you know, this is great. It's encouraging people to get to school early. Well, I think what it actually was doing was encouraging people to be selfish and to try to get the best things for themselves. So I stopped doing that. And I'm going to go home and try to tell them, you know, you need to have chair share time more often and give up your best chair for somebody else. And I'm going to try to make sure that that actually happens and that you're volunteering what you have for the sake of your brothers and sisters here. Okay, having a plan for the whole school. First of all the teachers in your school have got to know what their role is. And this is not, don't assume that they do. We had a teacher that seemed to think, that thought, and this is probably my fault because I didn't really have a handle on this either. She thought that her job was to teach these students their academics and that was about it. And that the parents need to be teaching these children behavior. And that's not my job. And she would get resistant to suggestions of, you know, ways to helping this or that problem. And, well, that's when we read Shepherding a Child's Heart as a staff. And we worked on some of that stuff. And it did change. We just hadn't talked. That wasn't clear for our school. And that was the principal's problem. So it needs to be clear. Everybody needs to be clear on what their job is. We've got to develop a school-wide set of goals for student behavior and attitudes and values and wisdom. This sheet right here is what I'm talking about. It's ACSI Expected Student Outcomes. This is from ACSI, which we are not a part of. I just pulled this off the web. But this is the kind of thing that I would like to have us develop that I think would be very, very helpful. Let's just read a few of these. The aim of our school is to graduate students with a Christian worldview who are well prepared in all academic disciplines, are skilled in reading, writing, speaking, listening, and thinking, are proficient in mathematics and science, have a knowledge and understanding of people, events, and movements in history, including church history, and the cultures of other peoples and places. And as you can see there, the first couple things are the normal academic areas. Then it goes on down number 8. They're committed to lifelong learning. Number 9, they have the skills to question, solve problems, and make wise decisions. And 10, they understand the worth of every human being as created in the image of God. And so on. It really is very good if we can actually do all these things. So I'm suggesting that we do work on developing that kind of thing. And we should probably do it one thing at a time instead of this whole list, and actually work on making sure this is happening in our school. And have a standard. What we're doing here is we're building a school culture and building school expectations and building clarity into what happens at school so that when new teachers come in, there is something to which they can fit in instead of having them responsible for creating all that in their classroom on their own and expecting them to know what it is. Because if you do, you'll have problems. We assume too often that our teachers just know what we are standing for. We get a good person in there and we hope for the best. And sometimes it is pretty good, actually. But most of the time, it could probably be a lot better if we had stuff of this clarity about what we're expecting in place. So some of these specific school-wide goals for student behavior could include things like kindness, helping other students. We want to see that happening across the board in all the classes. Courtesy, holding doors, greeting teachers in the morning and when they go home. Reaching out to younger students, older students reaching out to younger students. Older students wanting to eat with younger students at times when we eat lunch all together, making opportunities for that to happen and watching for it. Okay, the bottom part of your sheet here is what I really hope can make some of this practical. This goal, picture, and rhythm method of planning. Turning vision into reality. All right, so, for example, students, the goal is, students will become lifelong learners. Great goal. How does that look? That's what the picture part is. If we achieve this goal, how will we know we have achieved it? And that's what the picture is. So here is how we will know that we have achieved this goal. This is what it looks like. Students will be talking about what they are learning outside of the designated study period for that subject, as well as sharing with others things they are learning from books and places outside of school. Isn't that great when that happens? You know that something actually clicked when they actually are interested enough to keep talking about it after the class. You know then that it wasn't just a game that you and the students were in together, filling up time. This was actually something that was meaningful, and they care about it. And so you can't force that to happen, but when this happens, then you know that your goal is becoming realized. Another part of this picture, they will ask questions, not for the purpose of getting their lessons finished quickly, but to help them achieve mastery of the subject. It's kind of a rare thing, isn't it, sometimes? When they're just in the game, trying to play the game, they just want to get their lesson done. And they'll ask questions to help them do that. But when they actually truly are interested in what they're learning, they're going to ask questions that might even slow them down. I like that. On a field trip, students will be engaged, ask the guide questions, obviously be trying to learn all they can. Okay, so that's what it looks like. And then the rhythm is how things you can do regularly to help this happen. Rhythm or routine would be another word there. Regularly, every week, share something, the teacher, share something interesting that I've learned apart from any subject we are studying. Students will, here's another one now. Students will set goals for their own learning every 6 weeks, as well as reflect on accomplishment of their previous goals. Now, this, I actually got this goal picture rhythm, something that we did in school with all the teachers, and this is from a middle grade teacher. He came up with, I just copied this from what he came up with. So I think it's very clear what he's expecting here and wanting to happen. And I think we should use this for the whole school. And I think we should develop these for a lot more things like this. If we had came up with their own goals, similar to this, but not copying this, came up with how this would look and the things that we're going to do to help this happen, that could be very, very powerful. And then you can maintain accountability for those things after you have them. You can be talking about them at your meetings. How is this going? Have a regular time every week to maybe talk about one or more of those things. Make sure that everybody keeps remembering them and that they actually become a part of how you do school. Well, we're getting close to the end here. I have a couple of points about how to make this stuff happen. You have this vision. I'm talking to myself here. You want these changes to happen. But we get back and we just get into our teaching again. We forget all about everything we heard at the meeting. And the teaching itself and all the checking and all the work just kills us. And we're just dragging yourself from one day to the next trying to survive. And this is for anybody, not just teachers have this problem. The rat race of life can just kill our vision. Okay, that what we're letting happen there is we're letting the urgent dominate, and we're forgetting the important, which is to think about where we're actually going. So here's a suggestion from Howard Hendricks. Take 15 minutes a day, 1 hour a week, 1 day a month, and 1 week a year for kindling and rekindling your vision, making sure your school is headed in the right direction. I'll repeat that. Take 15 minutes a day, 1 hour per week. Now, these are in addition to the 15 minutes per day, spend an hour a week. In addition to that, spend a day a month and a week a year. And this is not just about school. I think this is more of a personal thing to make sure that you are living the life that God wants you to live and are accomplishing these things in the areas of your responsibility. The routines are powerful things. This is one of them. Think about the routines that you have in school. School is a wonderful place to have all sorts of routines that you do with your students. You can do a lot of things with that, by putting things into your schedule that happen over and over again. Don't be mad at routine. I used to be mad at bells because I thought that inhibited real learning because you just had to go to the next thing. Well, sometimes I'm still mad at them, but I recognize that routines are pretty helpful, actually. Well, back to Christopher Dock. I think everybody knows the story about how he was found when he died, praying. He obviously cared for his students a lot. And there's one thing you remember from this is that. And get this book, too. You can get it from CLT. It's his school management translated into English and a few other things written by John D. Martin. By the way, here's another book that's very nice. Boyhood and Beyond, Practical Wisdom for Becoming a Man by Bob Schultz. Great little devotional stories to read and very, very good wisdom in there. Okay, I think we have to close here. Thank you for your time.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.